Kisisa is an extremely intense parsha, as parshas go, for many, many reasons. All kinds of content in Kisisa. And Shishi is essentially the reboot, the reset, after the Maisa Egel has happened, and Moshe's plea to the Ribbono Shel Olam has happened, and now we're looking to re-establish the relationship. We're looking to set the new tone. And that's what this Aliyah is about, at least at the beginning, and perhaps it's what the entire Aliyah is about, depending on how you understand why various concepts are there. So Pasuk begins, this is Parag Amidalad, Pasuk Yod, Vayomer, Hine Anothi Koreis Baris, Neger Kol Amcha Esen Iflaos, Asher Lo Novro, B'chol Ha'aretz, B'chol Ha'goyim, He says, I will make a bris with you, and before the people I will do their flows, like they've never seen before, not in any nation, and everyone will realize that this is the work of the Ribbono Shel Olam, and this is the work of God, because no rahu, because this is something that is literally awesome, not awesome in the modern, somewhat cheapened sense, but in the literally awesome sense. So, as Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch and others note, that God is reestablishing the terms and essentially laying down here that, okay, we are going to start over, but you have to understand that the Torah has to be inviolate, it has to be absolute, and people have to recognize that Moshe's mission is unique. And Soloveitchik, in his shiurim, emphasized that this is now the bris of Torah Shebaal Peh, based on the understanding that before the Egel everything was Bechzav, and now we have the big chelek of the Shebaal Peh. And the miraculous part, and it flows, is that Torah Shebaal Peh is not something that is extrinsic to the Jewish people. It's not something that is outside of who the Jews are. It's something that becomes a part of them. And this is something that Rav Schechter emphasizes in his new sefer, Divrei Sofrim, that the idea of Torah Shebaal Peh as a sanctification that lasts, that endures, even beyond what would be possible with Torah Shebechzav, is because of that reason. Torah Shebechzav is external, is a physical object, and can be destroyed, while Torah Shebaal Peh is something that becomes connected to us, is something that transcends any physical limitations. And that's the miraculous part. More specifically, the Litzke Rav, the Znayim Torah, comments on this idea, I'll say, Mach, what God says, that which I am doing with you, he suggests that that's a reference to the Karnei Or, to the horns of light that Moshe had. And, of course, we believe that was unique to Moshe, as opposed to many not fully educated or aware anti-Semites throughout the world, who believe that they were horns that Jews ever since have sported. So the whole point here is, if indeed that is the reference to the Pasuk, is that besides the fact that they weren't horns in the animalistic sense, but that they were unique to Moshe, and that's a part of what the Pasuk is emphasizing. So it's a riot against the anti-Semites. So, in any event, he emphasizes, Rav Hirsch, that the context of the next few psukim, which emphasize Avodah Zarah and the like, and God's jealousy, Elkanah, is to make the point that if we're going to have this new bris, so then we have to establish that it's exclusive. That's the whole point. That's what got us in trouble here. And therefore, these points that talk about God's jealousy and talk about the problems of the Avodah Zarah are in that context. And the psukim say, Shmor lecha, Eisa shanochi mitzavcha yom, hini garish mipanacha, etz ha'amori, v'aknani, v'achiti, v'aprizi, v'achivi ha'yabusi, that all of these idolatrous nations are going to be pushed out. And yishom lecha, pentichros bris, liyoshev ha'aret, asher ata ba'alea, kaniyel mokesh b'kevacha. And you should be careful not to make a bris with them. And the Litzke Rav has a comment over here where he asks, well, why is that so terrible? Don't we like peace? Don't we like Rachmanis? Why would it be so bad to make a bris with them, to make a covenant with them? And here he emphasizes the idea that Kol Merachim Ha'Achzai, that whoever has rahmanis on those who are actually dangerous, on those who are actually cruel, they end up finding themselves in terrible positions. And this is very resonant in the contemporary context, because this is the constant question the Jewish people are confronted with in the state of Israel today. Do you go for a bris which may not be genuine, which may not actually lead to safety, or do you recognize that that's not always something that is secure, it's not always something that is for our benefit, and it could blow up in our face, which we mean quite literally today. And it's interesting also that the Litzker Rav, writing quite a long time ago, he uses pretty much that exact lashon in talking about the dangers of a less than genuine, less than full bris. And that itself is something to take note of. Okay, so Sukkim continue. Ki es b'chosehem ki totsun, vi es matzevosum tishaberun, vi es asherot tichrosun. So instead, you have to destroy all of their avodazaras. Ki lo sishtachaveh el acher, because you may not bow down to any other god. Ki Hashem kono shmo kel konahu, because God is indeed jealous. So what's the point of this pasuk? Is this telling us an issur of avodah zarah? So here the Oznai in the Torah has a comment that it doesn't seem like we really need the issur of avodah zarah at this point. We understand that that's what got us into trouble, and that's what got us here. So it's not so likely that we're going to hop on to the next idolatry. However, perhaps there is a message here which suggests that it's not the issur that's being conveyed here, but rather the point of a previous pasuk, that we should not enter into a bris with these nations, because that will take us down a bad path, which will also include worshipping their idols. So therefore, that's what the Torah is emphasizing. Don't enter into that situation, because one leads to the other. It does seem from the Gemara in Sanhedrin and Daf Samach and Yibes that this is a makar for the Isser of Azara, although that we know as well from the Asaras and Dibros and elsewhere. So the Torah Tzmiwa points out that what the Gemara is saying is that specifically in the context of Ishtachavah, we talk about bowing down. So there are different, if you learn the sugyas of Avodah Zarah and practicality, you learn that there are different types of Yisurim, that there are the methods of that particular idolatry, that there are certain idols that are worshipped in unique ways, and that would be an issur to do that, to carry out that process. And there was an issur of ishtachava by itself. Ishtachavaya is objectively a problem, regardless of what is the nature of that individual gozara. So therefore, the pasuk here is coming to create an issur on that specific issue, and perhaps that's the point. Okay, so now here, it's interesting also, and you'll see a little bit of synergy internally. We'll have a little internal aliyah synergy from one part of the aliyah to the next. So this is part one. And if you look at the next pasuk tezvav, so it says, Pentichros bris liyoshev ha'aretz, v'zanu acharei Eloheihem, v'zalfu Eloheihem v'karolcha, so we're worried that you make this bris with these people, and what will happen? And you will go illicitly after their gods, and you will sacrifice to their gods. And they will call out to you, they will invite to you, and you will eat from its, you will eat from their sacrifices, you will eat from that which they shed. So this idea, eating from their shrita, so the Rambam writes in Hilchos Shrita, the Rambam notes that this is the source for the idea that the shrita of an Oved Avodah Zarah is asur, even if every detail was done properly. This is in Hilchos Shrita, Perek Dalet, Halacha Yud Aleph, that even if everything about the shrita was done kedasu kedin, if it was done by Oved Avodah Zarah, so then it is off limits. It's a din d'oraisa based on this pasuk, which seems to say that there's a problem of achalta mezivcha, that just eating from the shrita is a problem in and of itself. So there is a discussion that if that's true, So then we should say, all right, the Isser should not be by any non-Jew, but should be by a non-Jew specifically who engages in idolatry. Then if we're not, if we're worried about idolatry, so then we should say that only an Oved Avodah Zarah has this issue, but not simply any Ben Noach. So the language of the Rambam in the next halacha, where he addresses this in Halacha Yud Beis, so he uses the language of Geder Gadol, that there was a big fence that was created here. In other words, implying that yes, we wouldn't have had to say that this Isser, because of its reason, should apply automatically to any Ben Noach. And essentially, this is basically a siyag. This is a gather that we're worried about the Avodah Zarah ultimately, so even a non-Oved Avodah Zarah Ben Noach, automatically the Shechita is no good. So the Kesef Mishnah comments, okay, so apparently this must be a Din D'Rabbanan. It's a siyag. But, as I think we've probably discussed on many occasions, that that's not the only way to interpret that. And this is a point that was made by Reb Chaim of Salvation, quoted his grandfather Reb Chaim as commenting here. This is quoted in the Mifnei Harav, that perhaps this is not a Siag D'Rabbanan, but this is an example of a concept of the Siag Ben HaTorah, that there are times when you could have a Din Ben HaTorah and it is still there as a protective measure. It's still there to asur against something else. So Adkan Divrei, the grafting of Mifnei Harav. But what's interesting to think about this is, so how does this affect the next pasuk? Because the next pasuk seems to also go a little bit further and tell us that there's a reason for the previous pasuk, that we're worried that you will leave from the Shechita. V'lakafta mivinosim l'vanecha v'zonu v'nosim acharei Eloheyem v'hiznu v'zvanecha acharei Eloheyem. We're worried that you will intermarry with them if you're going to get involved with eating their Shechita. So essentially it sounds like this is similar to the Surei Drabanan of Bishol Akum and the like, and Pas Akum, where we're worried, Mishom B'noseihem, we're worried that you're going to come to intermarry because of the attraction that develops through the non-kosher food. Through the non-Jewish food, not the non-kosher food, the food is kosher, but it's created by non-Jews, so we're worried that's going to create a hiskarbus, that's going to create an affinity, and that's going to lead to intermarriage. So is that an issue if the previous pasuk includes the gzeira, minatora, and this is also a reason? It sounds like there's a couple levels of gzeira here, that really the reason you shouldn't be eating from the shlita is because that will come to chasnas. And the reason for asuring it by all bnei noach is because that will come to those of Odeh Lezar. I'm not sure, is that all considered to be one concept? Is that a couple of different steps? And is there a problem if it is there an issue of what we call gzeira l'gzeira when you're dealing with gzeira min haTorah? So stay tuned, because that's where our inter-aliyah synergy will come up. We will revisit this issue before the aliyah is over. So it comes up more than once within this aliyah. So that's a semi-cliffhanger for the next few minutes. We will return to that issue. So, hey, Masecha lo sasalach, you should not make any molten gods. Eschag hamatzos tishmor, shibas yabim tocho matzos, eshet zivisicha, lumoeid chodesh aviv, ki bechodesh aviv, yatzasa bimitzrayim. So here, it gets a little random. We say, what's going on with Yantif all of a sudden? So Chazal understand that there is this connection here between respect for the Moedas and Avodah Zarah. They're called Mavazah, Samoedos, Gilu, Avodah Zarah. And presumably there's relevance here in both directions, that we're concerned that Bizayin to the concept of Yantif is itself an act that is comparable to Avodah Zarah, and maybe also it leads to Avodah Zarah, or it's a protection against Avodah Zarah to have respect for the Hashgacha of HaKadosh Baruch Hu as revealed through the Ovid Tovim, and especially through Shabbos, which will come up in a few psukim. So the idea that Chag HaMatzos you should observe for Malacha, Shubas Yamin, right, so here we're talking about the Yisra Malacha, it sounds like, so the Gemara says in Maseches Chagiga that is, that is the indication that on Chalamoid there's an Isser to do Malacha. And this is a major topic. I think we mentioned this in the past also. It comes up in a couple contexts as well, because this is the portal to a whole category of thinking, which also is discussed in Rav Shapter's new coming Sefer, Divrei Sofrim. There's a unique category that we have Yisurim Daraisa, we have Yisurim Darabanan, as we know. But the question is, how does the prohibition of Malacha and Chol HaMoed, how does it fit in? So this is a question that Tosfos brings up over there at Daf Ches and Chagiga, because it sounds a little bit like both. It sounds like, on the one hand, like Malacha's Chol HaMoed is an Isur D'Araisa, and yet, that's what it sounds like from here, as it's derived from the Pasuk, and at the same time, there are sources that sound like, or Gemaras that sound like it's an Isur D'Rabban. So here's where we get introduced to the concept of Maser HaKosav V'Chachamim, that there are ideas which are rooted in the Torah. They basically constitute Daraisa mandates, but Chazal were given their job of figuring out how they should apply, figuring out how they should be carried out. And Tosfos gets into a discussion, so what does that mean bottom line? Is that considered Maser Daraisa that was defined by Chazal? Or does that become an Issa D'Rabbanan? That's a whole discussion. But the most prominent example of this is this idea of Malachas Chol HaMoed that is provoked by this pasuk. And it's the most prominent example because of David Cohen, and one of his svarim has a whole kutras called Masar HaKasav HaChachamim, where he collects every reference that you find in later sources too. And he comes up with a whole very long list of mitzvos that could be in this category, so it could be there are many, many that might connect to this. But this is the most well-known example. This is really where the whole concept gets prompted, this example of Malachas Chol HaMoed that you find from this pasuk. Could be that there's not just many examples, it could be, as Reb Chanan suggests, maybe the whole enterprise of Dinim D'Rabbanan is really this idea, Masar HaKasav HaChachamim, that we get introduced to through Malachas Chol HaMoed. So there's a lot that comes out of this notion, so I just wanted to call attention to it in this pasuk. Next pasuk tells us, Kol Peter Recha V'chol Miknecha Tizachar, Peter Shor Vaseh. So every Peter Recha is for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and every firstborn among your cattle, whether it is a Shor or a Seh. So here we'll mention a little bit of timely references, because we're now in the time of Shlosh Yom. So the idea of Mechiras Chametz, a practice that has widely developed, that we sell our chametz knowingly and intentionally before Pesach to avoid having ownership issues, we sell it to a non-Jew. So the closest model to this in the Talmud itself, the Tosefta has a little bit of the basis for this. The Mishnah talks about selling chametz with the intent to get rid of it permanently, but in terms of the idea that we're selling it so that we can avoid a prohibition or avoid a halachic issue is perhaps most clearly in the Gemara, the beginning of Bechoros and Daf Gimel, based on this pasuk in the context of Bechor. That here it's a whole different level of necessity. That the Gemara says, you have a problem nowadays because if you have an animal that's going to have a Bechor, so what are you going to do? So on the one hand, the Kedushas Bechor will be relevant. On the other hand, you can't carry out the dinim of Bechor. We don't have the context in which to do that. So what's going to happen? You're going to get stuck. So because you really have a no-win situation, it's a greater tzorah than you have by chametz, where you have an option of just getting rid of it. So here, you can really be stuck. So the Gemara says, what you should do is the following. That this pasuk, Kol Miknecha, tells you that it has to be exclusively the property of Jews, and if the animal is owned by Jews and non-Jews together, the Shutfus, so then it's exempt from Bechor. So what we recommend is that you should enter into an agreement with a non-Jew who will own some part of the animal. And the Gemara has a whole discussion, how much of the animal do you have to own, what exactly qualifies, and that will therefore create an exemption from the din of Bechor. So there is some relevance to that to the din of mechiras hametz. There are some overlapping concepts. Nowadays also, people have to do this in order to address the situation. People who have farms have to know the halachos of mechiras hametz and how to apply it to mechiras bechor. It's not really, to be more accurate, it's not really you're selling a bechor, you're selling what's known as the behema hamevakeres. You're selling the mother that is on the verge of having a firstborn child. So that's what gets sold. And it has overlapping practices with mechiras hametz, and therefore also provides some of the basis for mechiras hametz, even though the relationship is a little bit questioned, because, okay, here, you're really stuck, you have no choice, and mechiras hametz, there are those who question how much of necessity it is, and that's a whole debate, but there is this timely connection to this pasuk. Okay, so this next pasuk has a lot of synergy, but in the interest of time, we'll just note the synergy and push it off a little bit, because the pasuk says, "Ufeta chamor tifta v'se, v'ulo sifta v'arafto kol b'chor banecha tifta v'lo yero fane reikam." So you shall redeem the firstborns, all of the firstborns of your sons, and you shouldn't come in front of me without a korban. So here's for the synergy, just a reference. This pasuk has a number of drashos that appear on Kiddushin Daf Chavtas. Our Daf has a number of drushas on this pasuk, but because we're on the verge, it's really the next thing we're up to right after what we were doing, God willing, on Monday, we'll start with that part of the Daf, so we will, in the interest of time, leave any further discussion of this pasuk to that, but in the interest of synergy, we have to note that there is a great synergy. This takes us right into our Daf. Okay, Sheishas Yom Tavo, Yom Hashvi, Tishbos, Becharish uvakatsir tishbos. All right, so you have this concept of resting at the seventh day after working for 6 days. So why do we have to mention working for 6 days? Is that a mitzvah in itself? Maybe. But Rav Moshe Feinstein in his Darash Moshe, so he writes that this is to emphasize the idea that it's only possible to work the other 6 days because of the tzivoy of the Kodesh Baruch Hu. And the Dubner Magid is quoted in the Paras Yosef as saying that the point of mentioning the 6 days is to emphasize that it's only really a chap if you're Shomer Shabbos, if you have work to do. You have work to do and you stop it, so then that really makes a statement. And that's related to the idea that the Rambam writes that the institution of Muktzah was created by Chazal. He has three reasons why. One of them is that we're afraid that somebody will be Shomer Shabbos technically, but may not actually have any work to do. And therefore, it's not going to be so significant that he abstains from work on Shabbos, and we need to add something to the mix to show that it's intentional. So Muktzah is this unusual way of moving things around. That's not something that people would normally do, even if they're without any other work. So that's something that helps to make this clear. So here perhaps that's what the pasuk is saying also, that Shabbos is really respected when we see that people who have work to do the rest of the week, but they stop for the purpose of Shabbos. That's what the pasuk is emphasizing. The Maggid says in that context, so for example, we find that when the Torah talks about the prohibition of taking ribbis, we're told we're not allowed to take interest when we give loans, and we're not allowed to take bribes if we are dayanim. And then the Torah promises a reward to kol osa eilat, to whoever does this. So he asks, isn't that a strange language that we're talking about prohibitions? Don't take ribbis, don't take bribes, and it's good for whoever does this. What do you mean does this? Doesn't do this. We're talking about negative things here, things that you shouldn't do. So he explains, and you could probably come at this on your own also, that these are yisurim, that only makes sense in a certain context. That it's not a chap to not take interest if you're not lending money in the first place. And it's not a chap to not take bribes if you're not a judge and nobody's offering you any bribes. So it's only significant if you are lending people money and you do so without taking interest. That's what we're saying, Kolo say, that if you're judging people fairly and you're not taking bribes, that's what we're talking about. This is so too, that sometimes we have to emphasize that we have a context in which it's possible to not follow this rule, and you're nonetheless following it. That's what the Torah is emphasizing. So he draws that comparison. But the truth is, it's even stronger on those points, because it seems really like it's not even such a kasha, though. So, hey, look, the Torah is saying that lend money without ribbis, and judge without taking bribes. As opposed to here, where it's not so clear the Torah is really saying that you must work during the week, but perhaps there is a parallelism nonetheless. So in any event, the emphasis of Shabbos here, in the context of Avodah Zarah, is, as Litzkarev points out, also to make the point that Shabbos is a skula against Avodah Zarah, is a kapara for Avodah Zarah. The Gemara even suggests in one place that a ger toshav, a person is going to be a non-Jew living in Eretz Yisrael, who accepts upon himself an enhanced form of the Sheva Bnei Noach, so he has to be very careful about Avodah Zarah, and so the Gemara suggests that maybe you should observe Shabbos too, because that's what shows that you believe in Maaseh Bereishis, in God's creation of the world. So a real makbin on not being over to Avodah Zarah is also going to be Shomer Shabbos. So the Gemara said, but that's a problem, because Shabbos is an oath for the Jewish people. So then the Gemara says, okay, so maybe you shouldn't keep Shabbos the same way, maybe you should keep Shabbos the way we keep Yontif. The Gemara says, well, Yontif is also an oath for Jewish people. Okay, so maybe you should keep Shabbos like we keep Chol Hamoed. Chol Hamoed is also an oath, which, by the way, is a raya that some bring for the idea of not wearing tefillin on Chol Hamoed. Chol Hamoed is described in that Gemara as also being an oath. So ultimately, the conclusion is that, okay, Ger Tosha should keep Shabbos like we keep Chol. Okay, so the point, nonetheless, is that there is a connection between Shabbos and Avodah Zarah, so it ends up here in this context, together with all the Yom Tov. This reference to V'charish V'katsir Tishbos, so it's a good question what exactly that's meant to highlight. The Gemara in some place, in the Rosh Hashanah quotes this as a source for the idea of Tosefes Shviz. Here's the Rishonim and the commentaries in the Kroos Kedolos have different focuses here. The Ibn Ezra quotes the Karoi in very harsh terms, and he says that they understood this to be a reference to Tashma Shamita, which they thought was prohibited on Shabbos, and he quite harshly disagrees with that. And the Unglos, Yaakov Kamenetsky, has a comment about both of these points in the Sefer Emes LeYaakov, where he interprets Unglos here to mean that this isn't a reference to the act of Charisha, to the Malacha, it's a reference to the seasons of Harisha and Tzira, and saying that the Shvisa should be year-round. Okay, so then speaking of year-round, so the next pasuk says, V'chag Shavuos Tasa Locha Bikurei Ktzir Chitim V'chag Ha'asif Tkufas HaShonah. So you shall observe Shavuos, and the emphasis is on the agricultural markers here, Bikurei Ktzir Chitim V'chag Ha'asif. So, Lutzkarav has a comment over here. It's always been a point of discussion, the relationship between the regalim that we have that correspond to various aspects of our history and yet also correspond to agricultural markers as well. And the Torah is explicit about that. It's not a coincidence. The Torah explicitly links them. So he has a comment that just like we say that the Jews look to the moon, that we have a good sign, a good imagery from the moon, and we take inspiration from the moon because we believe that just like the moon renews itself every month, so too we will be subject to renewal. So he goes on to say that's true about the sun also. So the moon's revolution has one level of significance for us, and our revolution around the sun has another level of significance, that's what causes all the crops to grow and everything to sprout and to blossom, and that also symbolizes the growing of the Jewish people. So therefore, because we want that symbolism, so Kadosh Baruch Hu was conveying the Yom Tovim throughout the year in the context of these agricultural markers in order to make that point. Okay, so we're told, Shalosh Pama Bashana Yeirah Kol Zechurcha Espnei Ha'adon Hashem Elokei Yisrael. So there is an obligation of Aliyah L'Rego. It's a good question whether this applies only when there's a Beis HaMikdash, or is this also true about the Mishkan, or is this also true in the Midbar? That sounds like a suffix in the Ramban, but the language of the Ramban, in the beginning of Hilchos Beis HaLechira, it sounds like it was true by the Mishkan also. I think we mentioned in the context of Parshas Truma, that the opening pasuk in Parshas Truma is understood by Rishonim to refer to a mitzvah, Sule Mikdash, Shachanti B'Sochab, is a mitzvah that applies to all the edifices of Karbanos throughout Jewish history. So it applies to the Mishkan, it applies to the Bayis Rishon, it applies to the Bayis Sheni, etc., etc. So therefore, it's all one. So when the Rambam describes this in the very beginning, home space of the Chira, so he mentions and the purpose of everyone coming there three times a year. So it sounds like, since it's inclusive of the Mishkan also, that the mitzvah of the Lila Rago also included that, but it doesn't have so much enough Kamina for the Maisa for us to figure that out, but that's a discussion. So here, this next pasuk is interesting. The pasuk says, Ki orish gayim yiponecha, v'hirchavti es kulecha, v'lo yachmor ish es arzucha, v'alozcha, v'eros es p'nei Hashem l'kecha, sholosh pamim v'shana. So God will get rid of these other nations and will give you larger borders, and no other man is going to be chomed your land as you go up to the Mishkan, as you go up to the Beis HaMikdash, three times a year. So this idea that no one's going to want your land, the emphasis seems to be that you don't have to be scared, you don't have to worry that somebody's going to attack you because they want it. And the Gemara Maseches Pesachim Daf Ches has a couple of drushes on this pasuk, and one of the drushes, which may or may not be the conclusion, is that this is the idea of Shluchei Mitzvah and Nizokin, that you don't have to worry when you're on your way to the mitzvah that you're going to be threatened by other forces. And there's a whole discussion back and forth in the Gemara, but there's an interesting comment in the Sefer Meloha Omer that says that, it doesn't just say the pasuk tells you you're going to be safe, it says, lo yachmo, they're not going to want, they're not going to covet your land. So you could ask, well, isn't that a natural reaction? People just may desire something, so how do we have this promise that there's not even going to be that desire? So, perhaps understandably, he makes reference to the well-known comment of the Ibn Ezra, a very sharp comment about human nature, where the Ibn Ezra comments on our prohibition of Los Achmon in the Aseret Dibros, and talks about very sharply about the idea of Los Achmon Eshes Re'echa, that you're not supposed to covet somebody else's wife. And he discusses, what does that mean? How is the Torah addressing a internal desire or emotion here? And he gives the whole picture. Says, imagine it's a little bit harder for us in a democratic country where, you know, things are a little different, but imagine going back a few centuries into a rigid hierarchy of a monarchy, and imagine if you have a farmer boy who decides he falls in love with a princess and he wants to marry her. So he's not even going to really think about it because it's simply impossible in his context that that's ever going to happen. Again, maybe in our world, better for us, that's not true anymore. But once upon a time, this was a useful muscle that the farmer boy is not going to even have a havamina that he could marry the princess, so it's not something he's going to try to scheme and plan to do. It's just not on the radar screen at all. It's something he recognizes from the very beginning is an impossibility. So that's the attitude one should have to somebody else's wife, that it's not something that you're even thinking about how to work out or how to make that happen. You recognize it's not even the remotest possibility. And there's an interesting discussion about how that svara applies to other type of losachmot by objects and by things. Is this all the same idea, that it's all about not even having a plan anywhere in your mind, that you're going to somehow devise a strategy that this is going to come your way? Whatever it is, but it's an interesting comment by itself. So Melo Omer applies this comment here, and he says that the pasuk is conveying that the hashgacha of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to be so obvious that the other nations of the world, it's not that they're going to be plotting against you and they're not going to win. It's they're going to recognize it's not even having me know that it's so clear that God is looking out for these people that there's no point in even thinking about it. There's not going to be any possibility of launching any attack, and that's what the pasuk is conveying. Okay, the next pasuk is also timely. It talks about L'Sishchat al Chametz Dam Zivchi, L'Yolam Aboker Zevach Chag HaPesach, so it's an Isser Shchitas Chametz al HaPesach, which has interesting implications for Tashbisu and the like. So Maybe that's also something we can push off till we get a little bit closer to Pesach, because we have still a lot more to say. So let's look at the last pasuk. Reishis bikuri ad masacha tavi beis Hashem elokecha lo sevashel gidi b'chalei bimah. So this is one of the three times in the Torah that we find the concept, that we find the prohibition of basa b'chala. So it's always phrased like this, lo sevashel gidi. And that tells us that there is a three-level prohibition regarding basa b'chala. Now, we're not allowed to eat basa b'chalav, and we're not allowed to cook basa b'chalav, and we're not allowed to get hana from basa b'chalav. So the question is, how do those three relate to each other? And this is a very interesting discussion, and here's where I said we will come back to certain concepts within the aliyah. So there is perhaps a machlokas you can map out, that there are two different tracks to understand the relationship of these three Yisurim, or two of these Yisurim, to each other. Because on the one hand, there is a statement in the Kesef Mishnah, in Hilchos Tumas Meis, the Perek Aleph Halacha Beis, where he understands the Rambam to be saying that the Isser Bishul Basu B'chalav is really there to stop us from eating Basu B'chalav. And essentially, the Kavanas HaTorah is we shouldn't eat Basu B'chalav. But if we create Basu B'chalav, so then it's likely, or it's risky, that we may come to eat it. So therefore, the Torah tells us, don't even make it, don't cook it in the first place, which is an interesting concept. Now, why is there a problem with eating Basu B'chalav? So that the Rambam of Moreh Nevuchim talks about, somewhat controversially, because he associates it with an idolatrous practice, which would make it consistent with the rest of this aliyah. If this whole aliyah is talking about keeping us exclusive from God and keeping us away from Avodah Zarah, so then you can understand why Basu B'chalav gets pulled in here as well. But the Rambam associates this with an idolatrous group, the practice of an idolatrous group that was long gone even in his day, and it provokes a whole debate as to how proper is it to assign Tamei HaMitzvos in a way that may make us feel very far from feeling their relevance. So that's a whole debate. The Rambam's comment here is a topic of a lot of discussion, but that's in terms of the ultimate Tamei HaMitzvos. But regarding the Isser Bishul, so it sounds like from the Rambam, Sadek Kesef Mishnah points out, and the Rambam elsewhere, seems like he's really saying this even more clearly, that the Isser Bishul is because of the Isser Achila. That's really, it's really about Achila, and the Torah keeps us away from Achila with the Isser Bishul. So that's an interesting discussion. You could find the opposite approach in some Sfar, some Achronim really building on a Gemara, that it could be that really it's the other way around, and that the main focus of the Isser is the Bishul. And it's hard to ignore the fact that the language is always lo sevashel. The three surim are all phrased the lashon bishul, which seems like it should be significant. And then maybe that's really what it's about. And that it's the opposite, that because the Torah says you shouldn't cook it, that creation becomes usur. So there's a Gemara, Maseches Chulin, Daf Kuf Yud Aleph, that sounds that way. The Gemara says that kol shetiavdu kol socha kol toeva, kol shetiavdu locha, whatever I have declared as a toeva, harehu b'val tocha, that is something that we're not supposed to eat. So it sounds like, essentially, that the Torah is saying that it's bad to create basa b'chalav, and once it's created, because it was wrong to make it in the first place, it is an isser achila that comes from that. So there is a discussion you could have about which with chicken and the egg, or the cart and the horse, what is the ikar and what is the tafel here? Is it that cooking is bad because it may lead to eating, or is it that eating is bad because it shouldn't have been cooked? But it seems like this is the Rambam's position, that cooking is a problem because it leads to eating, and that brings about many fascinating discussions. So for example, there is a tshuva in the Shemin Arav, the tshuva Stovek Meisharim, where he discusses a shaila that apparently Moshe Soloveitchik had the same shaila. So one of the Beis Yitzchaks a few years ago, Schefter, I think, wrote an article where he quotes Moshe Soloveitchik dealing with the exact same shaila and the exact same approach, but there's a truth about this in the Tshuvas Dovid Meisharim, where they talk about a certain laboratory test that was invented that they could figure out from testing a food item in the lab whether it contained basa v'chalal or not. But the test itself was an act of bishul. The test was holding this food up to the fire. It would involve an act of bishul. So the question was, could you do bishul of this possibly basa v'chalal combination so that you can ascertain if it is indeed basa v'chalal? So therefore, should we prohibit that as an issur bishul, or should we say it's okay? So the Chabinah Rav and Moshe Soloveitchik both said, based on the Rambam, that it should be mutter, because if the whole issur is that you are going to come to eat it, so if the point is you're doing this so that you wouldn't eat it, you'll discover that it's basa v'chalal and then you'll stay away from it. So maybe we should say, for that reason, it should be davka mutter instead of being asur. And to prove that point, to substantiate that point, they make another reference that's relevant to Pesach, so it's timely relevant, that the Gemara says in the first paragraph of Pesachim that maybe this whole idea that we have of Bedikas Chametz, maybe that's really a bad idea, because you're seeking out something which, if you find it, you're going to be machshel yourself. You're not supposed to be eating Chametz on Pesach, so maybe we shouldn't be looking for Chametz, which is going to get you in trouble. So the Gemara says, no, that the whole point is you're on a search and destroy mission, you're searching it to get rid of it, so we're not worried that that process is going to end up leading you to eat it. So they say here also that if you're doing this process to determine whether it is indeed prohibited basa v'chalal, so we're not worried that it's going to bring you to eat it, and that's relevant because if you assume that bishul is just about not eating it, so then if we can say that we're not concerned about eating it, that should be enough. So there are a number of shailas that are discussed in this vein. Then should we say that bishul basa v'chalal is essentially a gzeira, and therefore we can apply certain principles based on that? So there's also, for example, in Hilchos Chanukah it comes up. What if you have a Chanukah candle that's made out of basa v'chalal? So can you light it? Can you burn it? Isn't that going to be an act of bishul basa v'chalal? And there they point out, well, certainly it's not too likely you're going to end up eating that concoction, and therefore maybe that's a reason to be mekel. So there are a number of discussions along these lines that come up that address this issue. So to also fill in what we mentioned before, I would say we'll come back to our cliffhanger. So there is an interesting discussion that the Rambam says that you're not allowed to cook meat and milk. And midrabanan is also a prohibition not only of meat and milk, but of chicken and milk. Chicken is only basa midrabanan, but there is a prohibition of, quote, basa b'chalav that applies to chicken. But the Rambam says that there the prohibition is only eating it. There's no prohibition of cooking it. There's no prohibition of hanah. So why not? Why should there not be a prohibition of cooking chicken and milk? And to make the question bigger, it seems like it's against the Mishnah. The Mishnah, beginning of the 8th paragraph of Chulin, the way the Gemara reads the Mishnah, it sounds like the Mishnah is saying explicitly that there's an issur to cook chicken and milk. But that question aside, just misvara, if we say that kol d'tikun rabban ke'en d'raisa tikun, that Chazal basically followed the patterns of the Suri d'raisa, so why don't they prohibit also chicken the same way that beef is prohibited? So you can't cook or eat meat and milk, so you can't cook or eat chicken and milk. So you could perhaps suggest that based on this Rambam, that maybe you could say the issue here is gezeira l'gezeira. So that's what I said I would pick up on from before. We normally know that when it comes to Dinim Darabanan, so you have a concept of Gezeira L'Gezeira, that you can't have two Gezeiras on top of each other. So maybe we should say that that's the issue here also, that Bishul is a Gezeira for eating, and chicken is a Gezeira for meat. So cooking chicken would be a double gzeira. So the question is, does this whole language of gzeira gzeira apply to gzeiras daraisa? It's very hard to say that it does, because the reasoning behind not having a gzeira gzeira usually builds on the notion that we're dealing with isuri derabanan. So to say it applies to daraisas is a little bit surprising. So the truth is, Rav Yosef Engel says, Rav Yosef Engel in his essay about gzeiras daraisa, I think we mentioned that, and then in Klal Ches, Lekach Tov, he has a whole essay about the concept of gzeiras daraisa, which he made famous. He called that the attention of the world. So he quotes there a very difficult Prima Gadim. The Prima Gadim that says that there's an isser for a nazir to eat grapes. So the medrash that sounds like that isser to eat grapes is really a gzeira. That why do we care if a nazir eats grapes? What's so holy about not eating grapes? The point is we don't want him drinking wine. So grapes is one step removed from wine. So to keep him away from wine, we keep him away from grapes also. So that's apparently a gzeira d'oraisa. So there's also a concept that's very relevant to Pesach. Maybe we'll have the opportunity to talk about it more. That the concept of chatzi shir. We're not allowed to eat a kezias of chametz on Pesach. And anything less than a kezias is also the concept called chatzi shir. And a number of Rishonim seem to understand, based on their conclusions, that chatzi shir is also a gzeira. Is a din min haTorah, but it's a gzeira to keep us away from eating a full shir. So based on this, the Prima Gadim says, if we're going to have a chatzi shir of grapes, that's mutter, because it's a gzeira l'gzeira. And the whole concept's very difficult. Is that really true? That you can't have a gzeira on a gzeira, even on a level min haTorah? So it's hard to say that, but that might be an issue that is provoked by the earlier point in this Aliyah. Here, if we want to say this pshat in the Rambam, you don't have to go that far, because the Rambam could just be saying that chicken and milk, that's a gzeira midrabban. So maybe Chazal don't make gzeiras on something that's itself a gzeira, even if that first issue is a gzeira manatar. So that's a chiddush, sorry? Yeah. The point is that it's not as big a chiddush as the Prima Gadim. Prima Gadim says that even two gzeiras daraisa would not kick in because it would be a gzeira l'gzeira. So chatzi shir by grapes is a gzeira l'gzeira, even though they're both manat Torah, and it doesn't kick in. So that's very difficult to say, because the logic of the gzeira l'gzeira generally draws on the fact that we're dealing with Rabbanans. So to say that that's also a pshat in the Rambam here is easier to say. You don't have to be as radical as the Prima Gadim, because he's talking about assuming that Bishul is a gzeira min haTorah, fine. But then say to extend it to Bishul by chicken, that would be Chazal making a new gzeira. And maybe you have to make a little bit of the chiddush and say that Chazal don't make gzeiras on top of any gzeira, even a gzeira d'oraisa, but still we're talking at the end of the day about the d'rabbanan, so it's easier to say that than to say the bigger chiddush of the Prima Gadim, that a din and a Torah will not kick in if it amounts to a gzeira and a gzeira. So, just I thought you could support the view of the Prima Gadim a little bit, and then maybe bring a shtickel araya that is timely again, that is Pesach related, that there is a, first for support, there is a comment in the Elvis Reb Nosson. The Elvis Reb Nosson is the expanded version of Pirkei Avos. So the first mission in Pirkei Avos says, Asiyus Yagel Torah. You should make safeguards in the Torah. And in the Elvis Reb Nosson, where it's expanded, it says the same thing. And then it says, Ezehu Siag She'asasa HaTorah La'atzma. What's an example of the Siag that the Torah makes for itself? And it gives a discussion of we call Negia. So, first of all, just to the right for the whole concept of Xera Daraisa, so this almost of nothing is significant, seems to identify Xera Manatara. But also, maybe the whole statement of, oh, Chazal, you should make Xeras, and look how the Torah makes Xeras, Maybe the statement is that Chazal patterned their gezeiros after the style of the Torah's own gezeiros. So maybe the reluctance to impose a double gezeira, maybe that reflects the idea that even on the Torah level, that didn't happen. The Torah also only has one level fence, not two level fences, and that's why Chazal don't do it. So that is speculative, but I think also you could maybe bring a shtickel araya for the position of Kindergarten, that there is a view of Rishonim this way, is the Tosfos in the beginning of the third parak of Pesachim quotes Rabbeinu Tam, that the Mishnah there says Ve'elu over mePesach, that these things are over with, I forgot what that means, and it starts talking about basically second degree chametz, kol machmetzes, things that are not actual chametz but that are prohibited because of the broader term of kol machmetzes. So Rashi, it sounds like it means that you're in violation of Bayra Bayimatzer, you're not allowed to own these things. And Tosfos quotes Rabbeinu Tam says, no, this is not actual Bayra Bayimatzer, and Tosfos says a very weird line here, very hard to understand line, that this is Kol Machmetzes, these are materials that without the Pasuk, they wouldn't have been Aser. So therefore, they're not prohibited to own, they're only prohibited to eat. And when it says Elu Over, it means Over Min HaShulchan. You can't have it on the table when you're a Seder because you can't eat them, but they're not subject to the prohibition of ownership of Bayura Bayimatzah. So what does that Tosfos mean? So I think you could say what that Tosfos means is that Bayura Bayimatzah, not only Chametz on Pesach, according to the Ram, that's one of the examples of Gzeirah Min HaTorah. That's an example of something the Torah prohibited. Ownership of Chametz on Pesach is prohibited in the Torah. But the problem is that it will lead you to eat Chametz on Pesach, according to the Ram. So essentially, it's a Gzeirah Min HaTorah. So perhaps what Rabbeinu Tam is saying is that maybe he agrees with that, but Balirah Balimatzeh. And Rabbeinu Tam is saying, Kol Machmetzes is also a Gzeirah Min HaTorah. It's not actual Chametz, but it's something that could lead us to Chametz, so that's also a Gzeirah. So what Rabbeinu Tam is saying is it couldn't be, it would combine both things, that have Balirah by Kol Machmetzes, that would be a Gzeirah L'Gzeirah, and therefore it doesn't make sense there's such a din, and it must be that these substances you're allowed to own, you're simply not allowed to eat. So maybe this Rabbeinu Tam is a raya for the prima godem that there could be a gzeirah concern even on a level min ha-Torah. And maybe that's the strange line in Tosfos when Rabbeinu Tam says, oh, kol machmetzes, without the pasuk it wouldn't have been aser. What do you mean without the pasuk wouldn't have been aser? Without the pasuk nothing would be aser. Well, that's how things become aser for psukim. So what's the point? So presumably his point is that there isn't anything inherently bad about kol machmetzes. It's not something that really is a Pesach problem. Unlike chametz, chametz is inherently a Pesach problem. Kol machmetzes is really there as a safeguard. It's really there to keep us a step away. And were it not for the Torah telling us that that should be included, we wouldn't have assumed that to be the case. So perhaps that's what that line in Tosfos means, that it's not usher in and of itself, it's only usher as a gzeiras hakasuv, to be a gzeira, to keep us away from something else, and therefore it doesn't make sense to combine this with balyura, balyumatzeh, and there's no isser gzeira, l'gzeira, that there's a concern gzeira, l'gzeira, and therefore they shouldn't be combined. So maybe that's perhaps a little bit of a raya for the otherwise surprising position of the prima godem. Okay? Make sense? Alright, so with that, now let's just spend the next few minutes talking about Parshas Parah, which is an important reading, and perhaps as important as last week's reading. So there is a statement, last week you heard many people say, that I'll make sure to come to shul, because Parshas Zachar is the one time all year when the Kriya is Min HaTorah. So you could question both halves of that sentence. So last week we discussed the questioning of second half of the sentence, is it true that the laning is Min HaTorah last week, Parshas Zachar? But if we accept that it is, you can still question the first half of the sentence. Is it the one time all year? Because it could be that Parshas Parah is Daraisa. So this is a whole discussion, because Some of the Rishonim bring this up, or seem to bring this up, in the beginning of the third parak of Brachos. The Rishonim discuss, I think we mentioned this last week in the context of Zofar, the Rishonim discuss, why is it that the Gemara has a machlokas about the whole Torah, called Torah Kula? Is it B'lashon HaKodesh Namra or B'chol Lashon Namra? Does it have to be said Davka B'lashon HaKodesh, or could it be said in any language? So Tosfos says, well, who cares? What are we talking about? We're talking about learning. You have a Havmina that you can only give Shir in Lashon HaKodesh. We know that learning for sure is in whatever language you understand. So what are we talking about? For what practical purpose? We're talking about laning? Laning it wouldn't be, because laning is Drabanan, and the Gemara is interpreting Psukim to come up with this thing. So you can't tell me that Psukim are referring to laning, which is not an obligation in HaTorah. So in that context, Tosfos says, well, there are some kriyos that are in HaTorah. There are some times when we're obligated to read from the Torah, and that is a din in HaTorah. So some of the Rishonim will make the same point around Tosfos. Some of the other Rishonim, they throw in, together with the Zohar that we mentioned last week, they throw in Parshas Parah. So that gets everyone wondering, what in the world, where is Parshas Parah a mitzvah in HaTorah? Where do you see in Chumash that you have to read Parshas Parah? So this is a big brouhaha. Some say that it's a typo. Some say that they never meant to say this, that maybe in some of the Rishonim there was Rosh HaTevis, Pei, it meant to refer to a Malik also, it said Parshas Purim, and somebody misread it as Parshas Purim. So that's not likely to be the shot because it's a number of Rishonim who didn't get it from each other. So it seems like there is a real view out there that Parshas Purim is in the Torah. So the question is, where does that come from? Where do you see in Chumash any mitzvah to read Parshas Parah? A Malek, we know what the mitzvah is, even if we have a debate, if it really means you have to read from the Sefer Torah of the Minyan. So that was a discussion how expansive it really is. But if there is a mitzvah of a Malek, we know where it comes from. But here, where does it come from? Where does the Torah say that we should remember the Parah Adumah? So there are various suggestions in some of the Achronim. The Meshech Chachma has a comment that the Torah tells us Vizartim Yisrael B'Tumasa, we should separate the Jews from Tuma, so therefore we should make a big public reading of one of the details of Tuma V'Tara in order to make that point. Others comment that by the Paraduma it says in Lashon Kukas Olam that it's something that has to always be relevant, but nowadays we don't really have too much to do with the Paraduma, except for occasionally saying holy cow when we're amazed at something. So where does Parah Adumah fit into our daily lives? So since, like by the Karbanos, we have the idea that learning about it is a stand-in for actually doing it, so therefore maybe reading Parshas Parah is what makes it a permanent, ongoing institution. So you have a few suggestions along those lines, but there is a particularly interesting suggestion that can be found in the Malbin's writings and the Arugas of Osam and a few others, and it works out particularly well for years like this one when Parshas Parah is read this Shabbos. So there is a comment the Ramban has in his commentary to Chumash and in his comments to Sefer HaMitzvos that there is a mitzvah in Sefer Tvarim. The Torah tells us Zachar al tishkach es asher hetzavta shen lokecha b'midbar, that we should remember how we angered God in the desert, which presumably is a reference to the Egel Hazav. We should remember how we did that Avera. So if that's a mitzvah, so then hold on a second. The Ramban, in these comments, the Ramban says he thinks it's a real din. It's one of the 613 mitzvahs. This is something that we have to do. So if that's true, so how come we don't have a Shabbos Parshas Egel? So we have a Parshas Zachar al Malik. How come we don't have a Shabbos Parshas Ha'ego? So there are some who suggest that maybe we can make a Shidduch here. You know, on the one hand, we have a mitzvah without a kiyum, and we have also a din without a source. So maybe it's all the same. That maybe the mitzvah of remembering the Egel Azav, we choose to fulfill it through remembering the Parah Adumah. In light of Rashi's comments at the beginning of Kukas, quoting in Moshe Adarshan, that the imagery is there's a connection between the Parah Adumah and the Egel Hazav, that the mother is the Parah, should come and clean up the mess of the child, that is the Egel. So the Parah Adumah is a kapara for the ego, the Beis HaLevi has a whole drasha about this, where he says that the paraduma is a kapara for Avodah, because it's mystery, so the whole point is that you should stick with God no matter what, whether you understand it or not. So that's kind of the opposite of Avodah, so you see why it's swinging in the other direction, and maybe that's why it's a kapara beyond the bovine imagery.
Could it be that statement that remember what Hashem, when Hashem was mad at you in Midbar, could that be that that we didn't give the Karban Pesach in the Midbar?
So it's interesting.
And that's the Paraduma that we didn't, because we didn't do the Dinim of the Paraduma, because the Bnei Israel wasn't becoming tougher for the Karban Pesach.
So we have to figure out if that really works with the theme. I mean, it's an interesting point that you raised, because we'll come back in a minute to the question that it isn't necessarily obvious, as you're pointing out, that it's talking about the Egel Hazav. So that's a common assumption, but we'll mention in a few minutes another possibility. So certainly on that level, to bring up the question of should we take it for granted that it's talking about the Egel, there is definitely room to question that. But just to follow the Egel path for a moment, so this is how the Beis HaLevi explained the connection between the two, but also there is the imagery of two cows, or a cow and a calf. So perhaps the idea is that why is the Torah wants us to remember the Egel Hazav? So we should feel bad about ourselves, so we should feel guilty? So presumably not. Presumably the point is that it is a theme of tshuva, that we should know that even after we have stumbled badly, it's still possible to come back. So maybe that would say, all the more so we don't focus on the Avera, we focus on the Tikkun, we focus on the Tshuva, and that's why we take the more positive orientation of looking at the Paraduma rather than the Egel Hazav, but that's really what it's there to accomplish. So that's all very well and good if that's the point. If the point of remembering the Egel Hazav is to teach us about tshuva, so then this is a nice fit, and that could work. But there are those who say differently. There are those who say that the purpose of remembering the Egel Hazav is not necessarily such a inspiring idea as tshuva, but maybe it's more of a despiring idea, that de-inspirational, that we should be aware that we're always at risk, that we should never rest comfortably, and that we should recognize that even immediately after Mount Torah, even when we think we're at the highest spiritual levels, it's still possible to stumble so badly. So we're never secure. We have to always be vigilant. So if that's the message, so does it still fit to replace it with the Paraduma instead? So one could argue that yes, Adarab, it makes a lot of sense. Because this whole central mystery of the Paraduma that we focus on so much, how could it be that something can, on the one hand, be Metaris Atmeim, can confer purity on the impure, could also do the opposite, could also confer impurity on the pure, be Metameis Atahorim. So perhaps the message is, the Torah is trying to tell us that we can never just turn off our instincts and turn off our vigilance and go into autopilot and just rely on our externals, and just say, okay, we're in the right setting, we're in the right affiliation, we're in the right group, and it doesn't matter, we don't have to think about anything, we don't have to be careful. So the message is, here you have the Paraduma is ideally a kli for Tahara. But one shouldn't think that, okay, it's a kli for Tahara, that's all I need to know, so I can go to sleep at the wheel, and I can just push the Paraduma button, and everything will be fine. The message is that even when that is the default, there's still a need to be careful, there's still a need to actively watch what you're doing, and therefore that message becomes the dominant theme, and that is, in essence, a more positive way of focusing on the message of the Egel Hazav, that just like right after Mount Torah, we're still susceptible to messing up, so too, in the context of the Paraduma, we should recognize that as useful and as tahor as something is, it still has the potential to go in the opposite direction, and it's up to us to take responsibility for what's happening. So just to mention right before Mincha, that just again to go back to Donnie's point, they're back with Kamenetsky and his commentary to Chumash, that he understands that indeed, yes, there's a connection between Parshas Para and the fulfillment of this pasuk in Dvarim of Zachar Al Tishkach Es Asher Ksaf L'Shem Lekecha B'Midbar. But, like Dani is saying a little differently, he's saying he doesn't think it's necessarily about the Egel Azav. He thinks it's about Mara. He says that the fact that we were rebellious to God at Mara, that's what we are told to remember here. And there was that essentially we didn't believe that God could take the bitter water and turn it into something sweet. We didn't recognize his absolute control over everything that happens, even if it's not something that we understand. And therefore the Paraduma conveys that message, and that's why indeed it is a tikkun for that as well, even without bovine imagery. And therefore it's a different spin on this theory, that not necessarily about Egel Hazav, but about still finding that pasuk to be the source for the Hanhaga of Para. But it works out better for us this year, especially to say that it is the Egel Hazav, because it really is very compatible to go right from Kisisa, where we read about the Egel Hazav, to Parshas Para, if it's indeed meant to be the tikkun for the Egel Hazav and the mitzvah of remembering it. So we have all the two together in one Shabbos, so it's a particular opportunity to focus on these joint messages. Okay, with that we will remember the Egel Hazav by not being idolatrous and instead davening mincha. So who wants to